Open up the House Committee on Human Services on March 7th, 2011, and I open up a public hearing on House Bill 2856 and ask Karen Nibbler to come up, please. And Bobby Green and Patricia Baxter, please. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2856 was originally heard on March 2nd, and if you'll recall, it requires the Department of Human Services to create a pilot program with the goal of establishing a uniform audit process to encompass all information required by the department and other state or local entities, in addition to allowing abbreviated and less frequent audits for programs after several consecutive successful audits. And DHS would report those findings of the pilot program to the next legislative assembly. You also have received a dash 2 amendment on this bill, and the amendment would modify the requirement from the department to develop, but rather consider the feasibility of criteria for the pilot program. It modifies the terminology relative to the audit process and modifies the requirement of the department to evaluate the success of the pilot program, but rather report the results of the pilot program to the next legislative assembly. It requires the appointed work group of the department to use a continuous improvement or similar process to review the state reporting requirements.
Thank you. Good morning. Go ahead.
My name is Karen Nibbler. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I have a letter that I submitted earlier electronically, so hopefully you have that. And our letter says that we support this bill and that we're a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. We've been represented on the Government Efficiency Task Force subcommittees, and we agree with the intent of this bill. The League has a fiscal policy that states that we believe economy should be achieved by efficiency and responsible administration. The task force concluded that state and local governments should work together in a coordinated manner to reduce duplicate and unnecessary audits as a matter of course. Multiple jurisdictions and agencies could agree to criteria that are accepted for the function that's being audited and agree on who will conduct the audit. Further, the frequency with which an audit is undertaken could be adjusted to every other year. The bill appoints a work group to review state reporting requirements and a pilot program to reduce the administrative burden on human services providers. The League applauds this goal. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony and okay. Work on this. Thank you. Bobby.
Good morning, co-chairs Tomei and co-chair Gillum and members of the committee. My name is Bobby Green. I am the Director for Local Government Affairs for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'd like to thank you this morning for continuing this hearing so that we could provide testimony on behalf of the agency. House Bill 2856 is a bill that we embrace, although we have a couple of concerns with it. And those concerns have to do with unidentified resources that may be required to conduct this effort, the effort around a pilot program. Some of our agencies may not be able to do that, as well as our local government partners. They haven't anticipated what resources will be necessary to either share the work, coordinate the work, as well as trying to look at the feasibility of these pilot programs. We will do everything in our efforts to make sure that we accomplish the outcomes that are being required in this bill. The other thing that I want to put on the record is that the language around the audits, if there was an opportunity or the willingness to put some more permissive language around the audit and the reporting requirements as it relates to the audit, meaning that if there was language such as which would include an audit but not limited to, that would allow us to continue some of the work we've already began as recent as last year when we worked with four pilot counties regarding our partnership initiative. So if that was something that could be considered, we would greatly appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Patricia Baxter, our transformation manager, will talk a little bit more about detail based upon the recent submitted testimonies from last hearing. Thank you, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Bobby.
All right.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator for the Department of Human Services Transformation Office. And over the last 2 years, I have served in the role of team lead for the partnership theme of the Transformation Initiative. You're receiving my written testimony as well as an informational flyer about the work of the partnership theme over the last 2 years. As Bobby mentioned, we've been working with our county partners to streamline processes and to reduce administrative burdens. The department is committed to continuing this effort. You did hear testimony and receive written testimony last week about the administrative burdens placed on our partners, and we realize there are many. Our concern, as Bobby stated, with this bill is that it doesn't give us the ability to go quite far enough. Much of the testimony you heard last week talked about licensing, inspection, certification, a number of administrative burdens that go beyond auditing and reporting. So we just want to make sure that if this effort is undertaken, that we look at all of the administrative burdens facing our providers and not limit ourselves to audit and reporting requirements. Again, as Bobby mentioned, we do feel that this will impact a number of governmental entities, and so we just want to make sure that those resources are taken into account as well. But in summary, the department is committed to continue to work with our partners to reduce administrative burdens and to streamline processes so that our clients, get the services to which they're entitled. I'd be happy to take any questions, or I'm available in the future if needed to talk about our efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. Any questions of anyone on this panel?
Quick one.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bobby, did you have a written testimony? I'm just curious.
I can provide that.
I was looking for it. Okay. And the last thing was just to thank all three of you for coming back since we had to hold this over. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And Steve Pierce and Monica. Oh, let's see. And then we're going to get Monica Ford on the phone, but let's hear from Steve Pierce first.
That's not the wrong bill. That was supposed to be 2235.
Okie doke. Want to get Monica on the phone?
Monica?
Yes.
This is Jennifer. You're before the Committee on House Human Services?
Yes.
And we're hearing House Bill 2856.
Yes.
Go ahead, Monica.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Monica Ford, and I am employed by Morrison Child and Family Services. It's a large mental health agency and social service organization that serves the mental health needs of children and families since 1947. At this time, we hold multiple contracts with governmental entities. Recently, there has been a dramatic shift in the regulatory environment in Oregon. In order to hold contracts with state and local agencies, Morrison has been required to respond to numerous program audits and produce detailed written reports, access reports, quality assurance reports, practitioner reports, client outcome reports, in-depth fiscal reports, and corrective action plans are routinely required. During the past 2 years, Morrison has responded to a total of 44 requests for desk audits of agency policies, procedures, site visits, chart reviews, and corrective action plans from four state agencies. Additionally, policies and procedural manuals have been written and rewritten to meet regulatory requirements. The auditing processes by agencies are lengthy, detailed, and comprehensive. They are also duplicated, complicated, and overlapping. For example, child welfare and mental health have a similar requirement, but review at different times and require different formats. Over half of the auditing activities were conducted by mental health organizations that were reviewing the same program and using the same Oregon administrative rules. But it's not just the big agencies like Morrison. I have information from written testimony that was provided to the committee last week, but there was insufficient time to mention it in the presentation. I'd like to provide a sampling of a sentence or two from just a few of the letters that have been submitted. These are quotes. Klamath Lake County Youth Ranch in Bonanza, Oregon. The agency is reviewed, certified, and inspected routinely by the following governmental agencies: Department of Education, Department of Human Services, Drinking Water Program, Public Health Division, Oregon Youth Authority, State Fire Marshal, Department of Administrative Services, Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services, Klamath County Health Department, Klamath County School District, Northwest Accreditation Commission, and many local vendor suppliers and banks, Homestead Youth and Family Services from Pendleton. These reviews have significant overlap in the site visits, facility features, operations, and documentation they require. Each one costs us and the reviewing agency thousands of dollars per visit. Springwater Transitional Living in Milwaukee. This program went through 6 reviews during a recent 12-month period: a HUD program review, housing condition assessment and audit, a DHS review for licensing, which also looks at housing conditions, and 4 record review type visits, with 1 from the state and 3 from the county, one of which also looked at housing conditions. The next door in Hood River, Janet Hamada states, each year my agency devotes a minimum of 720 hours of staff time doing the reports and staffing the audits. The duplication in these efforts costs our agency money that would be better spent directly on the children we serve. And finally, back to my agency, we estimate that it takes approximately 7 full-time staff members to respond each year to the current level of auditing and reporting requirements. Staff salaries and benefits alone amount to $321,780. Ladies and gentlemen, we are confident that a reduced level of reporting and auditing will reduce the cost of care without reducing quality or outcomes for children and families served. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Monica. Have you sent your statement in writing?
Yes, we have.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Any quick questions here?
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. All right. Representative Nathanson, is there anything you want to add to any of this? Okay. All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2856 and open up the public hearing, which is a continuation on 2858. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2858 was originally heard as well on March 2nd. It developed a pilot program in Lane County by the Department of Human Services and the State Commission on Children and Families that applies to families with children up to 5 years of age where an investigation by the department cannot substantiate a report of alleged child abuse. The pilot program will require DHS to refer the child and the child's parent to the relief nursery within 24 hours for an assessment of the needs and resources available to the child's parents and recommendations for appropriate interventions by local resources such as respite services, parental education and support, alcohol and drug recovery interventions, and mental health services. DHS and the Commission shall adopt rules and report to the legislature January 1st of each year, beginning in 2013. You do have a dash one amendment at this point on the bill, and the dash one would further specify the location of the pilot program by replacing Lane County with Eugene, Springfield, and or South Lane County.
Thank you, Jennifer. No one has signed up to speak on this. Is there anyone here who would like to speak on this bill? Representative Greenland?
I received a flood of emails.
You did too.
Yes, me too.
I'm not sure how that campaign came about. I mean, not from my constituents.
Right. I think all of us did. Yeah. Go ahead. Sure.
My name is Kelly Sutherland. I appeared before you last week. I'm the executive director of the Relief Nursery in Eugene. And what I can do is provide a response to Mr. Williams, who spoke last week, and I think that might be the, I haven't seen the emails that you've been receiving, but it seems that the biggest concern was the nature of the services. And Relief Nursery services are voluntary. So the referral would be mandatory, but the parents accepting or receiving our services would be completely voluntary on their part. We only work with families that are at very high risk of abuse and neglect, and if the families referred to us don't fit that profile, they wouldn't be offered services. So again, they're voluntary. They take advantage of the services because they need help, and they have the option to choose not to participate. So the point of the project, this pilot project, is to make certain that the parents know the resources are there for them.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness?
Yes,
Frederick. Thank you very much for being here again. I will tell you that the flood of emails that we've gotten do not relate to the concerns that you were just mentioning.
Okay.
The concerns that they have, and a concern that I've had from several of my constituents, is the, and they are not in Eugene, so I will tell you that right now. But there's a concern that they once identified as potentially having problems are forever identified as being part of the having abuse in their homes, and that's part of what we're hearing, what I'm hearing anyway from the emails that I'm getting, a concern that that people are never able to get out of the. That there's no way for them to get out of being the stigma of having had abuse within the home, whether that's true or not. And that's what, could you speak to that, please?
Well, I think that DHS might be better to address that, and I think there might be someone here that could speak to that as well from DHS. But I don't know that the pilot project itself would remove that stigma. I don't know how it would impact it really at all. And the fact of the matter is, if there is a child welfare report and there's a call out and there's an assessment made and then a referral to provide additional resources to the family, I'm not sure how that stigmatizes a family any more than the fact that the call was made.
Well, if I may
follow up.
May I follow up, please? There's a particular situation in my community where a woman who was accused of abuse because of an observation by someone in a hospital that eventually was proven to be in error, but she was accused of abuse and as a result felt that had forever stigmatized her and traumatized her kids because the kids were taken out of the house immediately. And they are apparently still in significant fear of being taken away. Anytime there's a knock on the door at night, that's one of the fears that comes up with her as well. Again, she was exonerated, but feels as though that still has not come through yet. So that's where I'm getting some of the information that I'm getting.
Well, our goal is to never have a child removed if it's not necessary from a home ever, and I think. This what happened here in this situation happened would precede what we're talking about with the bill. The call was made and the decision was made, and maybe DHS can address that. But that's our goal. Our goal is for children to remain safely in their homes when they can. And so I think that in this particular case, that's, I understand. But two, we assess the family. So you have the referral that's made to us. We assess the family, and we would learn, does this family have the 16 risk factors that typically our families have? Do they live below the poverty level? Do they meet the profile of the families that we serve? And this particular case, that might not be the case. So, again, I think this is an incident that precedes what this bill is about.
Mickey, do you want to respond to this?
Yeah, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I do work in children, adults, and families, which is the child welfare program. And I think there was, when I heard the gentleman talk about the concerns for the bill, the reason we sent the email to all of you was for clarification. What we understand about the bill, and I believe this is the intent of the bill, is to actually keep these families away from the child welfare system. So these will be calls that come into our screening service, which currently exists. The report would be an allegation of child abuse or child neglect, and we either screen that call out or we conduct an assessment and determine that it's unsubstantiated. There was no child abuse or neglect. So all of that goes on record. And at that point, we generally offer those family services as we see they may need. What this bill does is take that referral away from the Department of Human Services and give it to a local entity. And in conversations and the way we anticipated this bill moving forward is a family may be more receptive to receiving services from an entity other than the Child Welfare Agency. So in hearing this conversation, what the intent of the bill, my understanding again, is that we are actually moving that family away from the child welfare system for the ongoing services, provided there was no abuse or neglect.
Representative Greenlick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We need to look at the plain language of bills when you start to interpret them, and the intent's not always clear. And I think it's the language of this bill that's a little scary. It says, you have a complaint, find there's nothing wrong. So you then intervene and send the family for an assessment. And it says, essentially, that the recommendations for appropriate intervention may include a whole bunch of things. It doesn't say they're voluntary. It doesn't say what happens if they reject them. I mean, in terms of the plain language of the bill, it sounds a little scary. My neighbor calls and says, I'm abusing my child. You come out and say, oh, no, you're not abusing your child. But you must go to here. It doesn't say that's voluntary. After getting evaluated, they say, well, you need alcohol abuse treatment. You need mental health treatment among the things that are offered. And how did that? How are you in my life now when I didn't do anything, and in fact, you proved I didn't do anything, or you don't have any evidence that I did anything, and now you're telling me I need to do these services, and it doesn't say in the bill that this is voluntary, that I don't have to come to the child nursery, I mean, to the relief nursery. I mean, it doesn't sound a little scary to you, Mickey, if this happened to your family?
Well,
that's the question. There was a question at the end.
Thank you for clarifying that. Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, I think the requirement in the bill is for the department to make a referral of services, and then those services are voluntary. Now, if you're saying that the bill is not clear on the services being voluntary, we certainly can work with Representative Nathanson's office to see if that would be acceptable to put that clarification in the bill. But the department, I think in practice, the way I've envisioned this and in talking with the local office, as you know, this is a county-specific bill, maybe to allow us to look and see how it operates at a pilot level. But my understanding at the practice level is that the department may in fact mention to the family, we will be making a referral to the relief nursery in Lane County. Will then go to Lane County with whatever information they need in order to make contact with that family to offer the services. If the family, upon being offered the services, decide this isn't the right time, this isn't the right services for them, they simply say no and the case is closed.
Hey, may I follow up, Madam Chair, with one question?
Sure.
Is there anything that stops you from doing this now?
We do make referrals to other entities in the community. In practice, we are more apt to give them a list of referrals as opposed to a single referral. We're more apt to, at the time that we've decided that there is no child abuse and neglect, give them that referral and then simply walk away and not follow up. So I think one of the key aspects to this particular piece of legislation is that follow-up piece, that there will be an entity other than the child welfare or child protective service system that would be contacting the family and seeing if they in fact would like to have those services, rather than wait to see if the family makes that call.
Representative Thompson.
I'm still hazy of why we need this bill, because if this is all voluntary, what prohibits DHS from referring a family to any local services available?
Co-chairs and Representative Thompson, you're absolutely right. We do make referrals now, but again, rather than making a referral to a specific entity, we tend to give a list of providers that are in the community. So it's a little more personalized than this, but you're right. We have the ability to make referrals to families.
Madam Chair. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the key to the answer to Representative Thompson the word requires? You say you currently do, but you're not required to make those referrals.
I believe you're correct, but in practice, we would make a referral to a family. Yes.
You started to answer Representative Greenwood's question, and I wanted to go a little bit further. Can you help me define, as the department sees it, the word referral? What are the Are there teeth in a referral from you all?
We would consider a referral giving information to the family about local resources are available, and it would end at that point. We would not follow up to see if they made a phone call, to see if that local resource made a contact with the family. We would look at that as beyond our authority at that point. And again, these are for cases that we have determined are not falling under the child abuse and neglect statutes.
Thank you. Is that getting to what you were talking about? And I guess the last thing would be, at the end of this pilot, provides for collaboration between the department and the State Commission on Children and Families. So we would be relying on the State Commission for the parental, not totally, but for the parental constituency. Is that right, through the way the commission is set up? Because I want to make sure that when you get done with this, that families are directly, have direct input into how the pilot program went. Does that make any sense? Not really.
Yes. And I'm
say kidding. Again.
When we're all done with the pilot and you're required to make this report, the families having input into how it went would be the vehicle would be the commission, I assume.
Well, the department would make the initial referral. The provision of that is through the relief nurseries, which is sponsored by the Commission on Children and Families. So I would say yes, that okay. That would.
May I? I would like to just remark.
You can move on.
Okay.
Very briefly, go ahead.
Just Representative Thompson's remark, I think the purpose really is that we can gauge our success, that we have a method by which we can determine if we're being successful, in addition to our independent evaluations, which show we reduce child welfare reports and we show we reduce foster care placements, that the pilot project, the intent is that we can gauge our success. And that's the purpose. And we create programs based on our families' needs. And so we would, in answer to your question, Co-Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And I know we have an amendment coming. Representative Nathan was nodding in the back. So we'll have a further hearing on this in the future. So with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2858, the -1 amendment. And I'm going to be opening up a work session on House Bill 2217 and 2464. We are holding these over until the Wednesday agenda, and I will close the work session on 2217 and 2464. And I will open up a hearing on House Bill 3110, and I'm going to hand this over to you, Mr. Co-Chair, while I go down there.
All right.
And speak.
I'm going to close the hearing.
I would say you were quick on your feet, Mr. Speaker, or Chair, but you were sitting down.
Did you call me Mr. Speaker?
Looking up. Fantasy time.
Really?
Please proceed. I'll get this under order, in order if I have to.
Colleagues, I'm Carolyn Toomey, State Representative for House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Speaking to you in my capacity as the Legislative Representative on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, thank you for your consideration of House Bill 3110 before you today. Alcohol and drug abuse is a huge problem in our state, as I think you know, affecting not only individuals, but our community as a whole. It fuels much of our property crime. It is responsible for lost productivity in the workplace. It adds to the cost of health care for us all, and it tears families apart, sending children into foster care. And, you know, we could all go on and on. So the policies that we as state legislators adopt regarding alcohol and drug prevention and recovery are vitally important to our state. And I say prevention, treatment, and recovery. All three of these things intentionally. Much of our work has been traditionally focused on the treatment side. When an individual reaches a crisis point, we treat them, then send them back out into the community with little notion of what happens next. Certainly, we have no efficient way of tracking individuals who bounce from crisis to crisis, program to program. A&D prevention, treatment, and recovery programs are housed throughout various state agencies, local governments, private nonprofits, tribal councils, each with its own silo of funds, often not talking with each other. We have no systematic way of evaluating the effectiveness of programs. We have no way of assuring that our alcohol and drug dollars are getting the most bang for the buck. Last session, with House Bill 3353, Attorney General John Kroger took on the ambitious task of developing a strategy for coordination and evaluation of our alcohol and drug policy. Together with Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services, Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections, Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction, he brought stakeholders from across the state, including researchers who understand evidence-based best practices, law enforcement officers, treatment providers, prevention specialists, local government officials, and many more. This group has been working diligently since then to craft a comprehensive alcohol and drug policy. It was exciting and exhilarating to be a part of that group. House Bill 3110 represents one piece of that work, a restructuring of our alcohol and drug policy system design. And now I will let the experts tell you more about the specifics in this bill, and I thank you for your consideration on this important work.
While she's coming back up, Attorney General Kroger and Bruce Goldberg, if you'd come on up, we'd get started when she returns.
Jennifer, do you want to read the...
Certainly. Members of the committee, House Bill 3110 removes the sunset provision on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. It adds ex officio members to the commission representing the Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, State Commission on Children and Families, and Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Designates the commission to establish pilot programs in Oregon communities to phase in and implement long-term treatment plans and prevention programs. It specifies the committee create a budget advisory committee to establish or approve minimum standards for drug prevention and treatment programs financed with state or other funds administered by the state. Establishes a governor-appointed director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to develop a science-based model alcohol and drug abuse prevention program for use in conjunction with the pilot programs.
Thank you, Jennifer. And we call up...
Oh, there they are.
Good morning, gentlemen. As if by magic.
Good morning. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon and the Chair of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, thanks for having us here this morning. I won't go into detail about the need to have first-rate treatment and prevention programs in Oregon. I think that's something that there's very deep bipartisan support for in the state. I will simply say that if you look at major drivers of cost of government, including our criminal justice system, our child welfare system, our healthcare system, drug and alcohol abuse is at the very top of the list for drivers of those costs. As a prosecutor, I will simply tell you that the criminal justice system is overwhelmingly devoted to dealing with problems created by alcohol and drug abuse. And so to the extent that we can have a truly world-class prevention and treatment system in Oregon, that will go a long way to cutting the cost of those programs and reducing the amount of crime and human suffering related to addiction. The bill that is in front of you does five very important things. First, it creates a statewide director for alcohol and drug policy responsible to the governor and to the commission in order to coordinate all of our efforts, not just around prevention and treatment, but alcohol and drug policy in general. There are two real big motivators for creating a statewide director. One is that currently all of our policies and programs are siloed amongst numerous different state and local agencies. And without having one person who is responsible for these things, we're never going to get a truly unified, coordinated strategy. I've seen in my 2 years in state government that if one person is not responsible for something, it's very hard to make progress. This recommendation is also based on every national study of state drug and alcohol programs. Best practice that has emerged in the study of those programs is to have one person coordinating all of the efforts at the statewide level. The second thing this bill does is create a requirement that the executive branch submit a unified budget for its treatment and prevention programs to the legislature. Again, this is designed to overcome the problem of having silos where each agency, which has a piece of prevention or treatment, brings its own separate budget to a separate subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee, and we don't have a truly comprehensive discussion about what the overarching strategy is and why certain priorities come higher than certain others. The agencies are just sort of left to advocate for their own policies and their own programs as best they can, and the end result doesn't necessarily reflect a coordinated strategy. So pursuant to this bill, the executive branch will be required to put its heads together before the legislative session and submit a unified budget to the legislature so that the members of the legislature can see the big picture and not just a particular silo. Third, it mandates the creation of a unified data collection system for our treatment programs around the state. Right now, we simply cannot provide the legislature with the kind of concrete data about the costs associated with various different types of treatment and their impact on things like the recidivism rate for crime, employment, or healthcare outcomes. And without that kind of data, I think it's impossible for the legislature to make the prioritization decisions it needs to make. And so this bill will require us to create that system. We're already working on the basic infrastructure of what that would look like. There is very good software that is out there that is open source software to help states do this, so that this is not going to require a giant state-run IT program. A lot of the software is already out there to do this. And what this will enable us to do is really for the first time give apples-to-apples comparisons of various different types of treatment and their impact on health and recidivism outcomes. Fourth, it authorizes the commission to create pilot programs in prevention. If you look at our prevention efforts around the state, I think there are three main problems. One is that we've generally underfunded prevention efforts in the state. We certainly have underfunded treatment, but the underfunding on the prevention side, I think, is even greater. Second, a lot of the things that we are doing do not fit scientific, well-established best practices. And third, we often water down our efforts to such a significant extent by spreading a small program across a huge population that you're really not getting a real measurable impact on a particular community. The goal of the pilot projects is to serve as the basis for what eventually would be a truly world-class system in Oregon. We've asked for authority to create up to 10 pilot projects. We've designed the pilot projects. They each cost about $750,000 apiece and would serve a community of roughly 20,000 people. The governor has put funding in his budget for two of those programs. I'm going to ask the Ways and Means Committee to increase that to fund four of these pilot projects in this biennium. And then we will go out and go to the nonprofit community and seek to raise the rest of the funds through major grant-making bodies. The pilot projects are designed to provide scientific best practices that truly will have an impact, things that have been proved in very large population data sets over decades to truly cut drug and alcohol abuse, as well as related things like arrest rates and dropout rates for children. And to do this in these best practices in a very concentrated manner, so you can actually test and measure the impact that the programs have. And finally, this bill gives the director the ability to cut funding for programs that are not meeting minimum standards. And for me, this is a basic requirement of accountability. If we're going to start effectively tracking data to measure the outcomes of programs and to set clear standards about what standards need to be met, then we need the ability to remove the funding in midstream, in the middle of a biennium, for a program that is not meeting those standards. The overarching philosophy here is very simple. We knew going in that this was not going to be a biennium in which there would be a lot of money to invest in either treatment or prevention. And rather than seeing that as a barrier, we took that as an opportunity. The goal of this bill is to start creating the infrastructure that is necessary to build a world-class system. The infrastructure both in data collection and coordination of government policy, and to start creating the pilot programs and prevention that eventually, if as we think they will prove successful, we can then scale those out over a broader population.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority, and I also serve as vice chair of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. I'm here today to speak in favor of this bill, and following the eloquent comments of Representative Tomei and Attorney General Kroger, will be fairly brief. I think we all know that we spend way too little on our care of alcohol and drug issues, too little on prevention, too little on treatment, too little on recovery. And sadly, we spend way, 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 way too much on its effects in our prisons, in our courts, in our child welfare system, in our hospitals, in our schools. We've got to turn that around. And our journey to do that in this state actually started several years ago. I know that Representative Greenlick and some others have talked about the need for better coordination of these services. Director Williams and myself commissioned a study about 3 years ago now on the amount of dollars that the state spends on alcohol and drug treatment. And that study put together a diagram which we continue to call the spaghetti diagram, because it looks like a bunch of spaghetti thrown on a wall. it really does. There's lines going all over the place, and it's time to do something about that. We need to do that in a more coordinated fashion. And right now, we've got a tremendous opportunity. I think our fiscal crisis, as well as our need to help government operate more effectively, really provides us with the impetus to better coordinate how we use our resources. When you live in the desert and water is short, you really understand how to conserve and how to use resources better. We're certainly in that situation right now. We have a tremendous opportunity to better coordinate our funding, to break down many of the silos, to put things together in a way that it hasn't been before. I think that we can, A, get much better value out of the resources that we spend if we coordinate them better. We can begin to put dollars into prevention. We can track outcomes. And I think that we can begin to create the kind of world-class system in this state that people deserve. But it has to start with coordination of resources across the multitude of programs that have a foot in this. This bill does that. I think it's a tremendous start, and I would urge your support.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Yes, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce, this is kind of for you. What one program for alcohol treatment is probably the best program out there that you've seen?
Co-chairs, representative, I don't know that I could answer that. I think that we have a number of programs that have demonstrated success. I don't know that I could tell you the one that has the best outcomes, and I think that that is part of what underlies this bill, is that we measure the outcomes of programs in a variety of ways and have no single way that we determine outcomes of treatment. And so that's something that this bill will begin to address.
May I follow up?
Have you heard of Alcoholics Anonymous?
Co-chairs, representative, yes, indeed.
Would you say that's probably at the top?
I am unfamiliar with their outcomes. I know that they do a great job in engaging people. I know that they get outcomes. I don't know how they compare to others.
May I
follow up?
Are you familiar with Celebrate Recovery?
No, I'm not.
So these are programs that are all private, done by people that go through the programs, and I don't know, doesn't sound like you're familiar with them or have been involved in any of the addiction programs. I don't know if you have, Attorney General Kroger, but these are programs that are looking for people to help. And with a lot of the things you'll run into, being involved in this arena, not by choice, but because of family members, and have a brother-in-law who does Celebrate Recovery, people aren't going to change because we send them to a class. I have a father who went to 5 different rehab centers, each one completely different for alcohol. And until he decided to change, that was the only way he was going to change. We can send him and put this together and say you're going to go, but unless the person wants to change, they're not going to change. So I'm just wondering why we would really have a bill saying you're going to go. They'll go to the classes, but I think we might be spending money that we don't need to.
Co-chairs, representative, and I'd also be interested in the Attorney General's thoughts on this. I don't think this bill mandates where people go. What it does is it begins to set a framework for evaluating individuals. Because indeed, you're correct. What we do know is that the more ready someone is for treatment and for recovery, the better the outcome will be. And what this bill does is begin to coordinate a way in which we can, as a state, gauge someone's readiness for treatment and begin to determine what sort of programs are the best for those individuals. Because indeed, you're correct. Not everybody is ready for change, and indeed, mandating people to programs may or may not, in certain circumstances, be the best strategy.
Co-chairs, representative, the simple thing I would say is that the overarching strategic goal I think all of us have is to prevent the development of addicts and alcoholics in the first place, and part of the major goal of this is to start to build that prevention system. I agree with you that I'm not shy about this. I went through Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm intimately familiar with it. It is correct that until someone really is at that point where they're ready to make a change in their lives, they're going to have a hard time getting a grip on their addiction. One of the things, though, that treatment and recovery programs do is try to provide people with the information they need to help think through and start to make that change. Part of the reason treatment and recovery works doesn't always take on the first try, but part of the reason it works is in part it helps educate people about the need to change their lives. And so I agree with you 100% that unless you've got that person that's at that point in their lives where they recognize they've hit rock bottom and they need to make a choice and a change, it's not going to work. But these programs, I think, are very helpful in helping people reach that point. And so that's part of the goal of getting people into these programs.
Representative Harker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to both of you for the testimony. Representative Greenlick and Senator Bonamici and I had a town hall meeting this weekend, and one of the gentlemen that came to speak at that town hall meeting had, I think, 9 years ago been, had his life interrupted and been entered into what he referred to as state-sponsored very effective therapy. And it had provided, correct me if I missed
it. Was in prison, though.
Pardon?
It was in prison, right?
He turned his life around with respect to drug and alcohol abuse, and had many good things to say about the investment at that point in time and the fact that he was now straight and had been so for 8 or 9 years. And so I think there's ample evidence that some of these programs we're engaged in are effective. 100% effective? Definitely not. My question is about these proposed pilots. Is the program far enough along in development that you have a feel for how long the pilots would run and what kind of I don't want to go into the statistics and power calculations and such, but do you have a feel that we're going to get some meaningful results in a reasonable amount of time and make a decision about their efficacy?
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Harker, what we've done is identified roughly 30 or 40 interventions, everything from prenatal care to programs for high school students that have all been, if you will, battle-tested in other places amongst very diverse populations and have been proved to work. Some of those things, some of those interventions, some of those programs do show a very quick short-term turnaround, but a lot of them, you're really going to see the impact decades later. For example, one of the most effective and cheap interventions is a thing called the Good Behavior Game, which is a thing that is done in classrooms with kindergartners and first graders. And the data sets show that the bang for the buck comes when they're high school seniors. When you get to high school and you measure the difference in the population that's gone through that program and those who have not, what you see is lower addiction rates, lower arrest rates, lower dropout rates. And so some of these things will have the proof will be in the pudding, but you're not going to see it until those children get into riskier years. So the complete data set won't be there for 10, 15, 20 years. That's part of the reason why it's important that we fund things that have been tested and proved effective elsewhere, so that we're not gambling on something that we're not sure it will work, but are funding something that the scientific community is 100% confident, given decades of research, will have the impact that we want.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of that being said, are we, in conducting pilots of things that have been practices which have been very well established in other parts of the country, are we going to be randomizing people in and out of what have already been proven to be effective therapies?
Co-chairs, Representative Harker, yes. Part of our goal here is to build a very sophisticated model for tracking the results of the programs here in Oregon, and it is our hope that we're going to have federal funding to do that. NIDA, the National Institute of is it drug abuse?
Yeah.
We've had extensive conversations with them about funding the analytic outcomes measurement portion of this, because no one has really done this quite the way we're doing it, which is to really build something remarkable, funding a whole level of interventions in a very concentrated effort to see what the impact is. So we are going to be studying the outcomes here in Oregon, but we're placing our bets, if you will, on those things that have been proved successful in other places.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you very much. I think we have a witness coming up who's going to answer some of these questions in a better way. First, a comment. I think you've done an extraordinary job, and I think it's been extraordinary because it's been you two and Max Williams and Suzanne Castile and people who are really responsible at a level that can take charge. So I think you've just done extraordinary, and I compliment
both of you. My question is, there are some other agencies around, and I wonder if you've explored the extent to which they ought to be involved. I think of state police, I think of Boley, I think of other organizations that are involved either in treatment or in interdiction or a variety of other kinds of things. I wonder if there's if you have a sort of eye in the future of spreading even broader than the extraordinarily wide wings you've spread already.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlit, we've begun that already. Boley's at the table. We've looked at the Department of Transportation and the dollars that they spend through a variety of community service announcements and ways that they're involved in this. OLCC, Commission on Children and Families, Oregon Youth Authority, we Department of Education, we go on. I mean, part of this has been exactly that. Our vision has been to get those folks engaged now and not wait for the future to do this in a really coordinated way.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Frederick.
Thank you again, and I'm going to echo what Representative Greenlit has said. Really appreciate it. I want to continue to be concerned about the making sure that the folks who are consumers of the services are part of the discussion about how effective they are. Because what I have found is that we have often decided that we know what they're supposed to be thinking about, and we don't. So if there's a way to encourage more involvement, more participation on the boards, on the evaluation teams, on whatever of those consumers, of those folks, and a range of folks. There is a difference between folks who are involved, although there's a basic addiction issue. There's a difference between someone involved in alcohol addiction and meth. And so it's important to make sure that that's the case. I know that there's one person who's listed as being on the commission who is a consumer, officially, I think, listed as consumer of services. Are there others that are planned, and are we going to expand that?
Co-chairs, Representative Frederick, when the commission was set up, we certainly had a specific slot held for someone who was in recovery who could speak to the particular concerns of consumers of our treatment system. I would say that almost all of us who are on the commission and who've been involved in the development of these proposals have interaction with the system from a variety of different perspectives. Even though we've set aside a slot for someone who's in recovery, I'm chairing the commission and I'm in recovery. We certainly have lots of people who are providers who interact with, the folks who are getting treatment on a daily basis. And so I think we have had that a broad amount of input from a whole variety of perspectives, everything from people who are recovering addicts to people who are in law enforcement who spend most of their time arresting people who are addicts. I think our goal is to continue to have as broad an input as possible. And I just assure you that the particular views of people who are actually attending the various different programs that are part of this system will not fall through the cracks.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. We're going to move on to our next people are coming to testify. Thank you very much. Dennis McCarty, John King, and Sarah Goforth. Oh. Richard, somehow your name didn't get sort of crossed out. I'm going to call Richard. Did you want to come up to testify, Richard? Please come on up right now. That wasn't crossed out, right?
Go ahead.
Sarah, well, I was going to invite Richard. Yes, would you mind? I'm sorry, because Richard's name was ahead of yours, and I just had somehow missed that. Richard. Oh, how sweet.
Where are we?
Okay, no. Richard, I'm going to let you go next.
Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam, my name is Richard Harris, and I'm the Director for Addictions and Mental Health for the State of Oregon. and I'll make my comments fairly brief this morning. But I just want to remind the committee about the magnitude of the issues of need for recovery services in the state of Oregon. We have over 300,000 individuals, adults and children in the state of Oregon, who are in need of some type and some level of recovery services, whether it's treatment, detox, inpatient residential programs, outpatient, DUI. There are a large variety of need in the state. And the sad part about this is right now we're serving about 20% of those individuals. So about a little over 50,000 adults and kids are in our publicly funded and I would say publicly and privately funded, because in the world of addictions treatment, most programs are funded by either state funds or federal dollars, but also a lot of funding that is developed by the programs in order to support themselves. So most of the services, over 200 providers in the state of Oregon, are providing those essential services, and much of it is paid for through the fundraising of those organizations. So when Dr. Goldberg referred to the spaghetti chart, I actually refer to it as the spider chart, it does not identify in that analysis how much funding comes from the private sector in all of this. So many of our programs are funded through the efforts of local communities, local providers, are funded by private dollars. But even at that, we're only serving about 54,000 people, which is less than 20% of what the need is in the state of Oregon. So what we're approaching here, in fact, the sort of discouraging part about this is that 2 years ago when we did the prevalence study and compared it to the need, we were about 22% of the need that we were covering. And so we have actually gone down in the last 2 years. Part of that is because of the increase in caseload growth, and the economic times we're in causes displacement into the alcohol and drug treatment system. So we're not doing too well in the state of Oregon. That doesn't mean we're different than other states, but no state in the union that I know of has done an adequate job with covering the large number of people who have addiction problems. So anything that is going to help us consolidate and focus our efforts here in the state has to be seen as a positive thing. The idea behind the commission to get all of the state entities who have responsibility for some aspect of this problem to come together, to coordinate their services, to focus the funding on those things that work the best, is exactly where the state needs to go. We will never have enough resources to treat the total need, but we can do a lot better job if we focus the resources we have. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation, that it's essential that we do this. I've been in the alcohol and drug treatment field for over 30 years, and as a provider, I have a lot of ideas about how programs work and what makes them outstanding programs in engaging people in recovery and what the long-term effects are. But clearly, one program is going to solve this problem. People have a variety of different kinds of issues when it comes to addictions, and it needs to be addressed at a variety of different levels. 12-step programs are an essential part of what goes on, but in the actual intervention and the treatment of individuals is a primary concern as well. Just one more thing, and that is, as we're talking about the integration of health, mental health, addiction, and long-term care services in our health transformation, we should not lose sight of the need to make sure that addiction services are included in this larger picture, because people with addictions frequently have lots of other health issues, and intervention through the health care system for addictions is one of the most effective methods that we know of. So I'm strongly in support of this measure, and have high hopes that it'll help the state of Oregon get much more focused on the need for recovery and treatment and prevention.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from all three gentlemen, then we'll take questions. Okay, let's see. Dennis, I think you were next.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, committee chairs, Representative Tomei, Representative Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Dennis McCarty. I live in Clackamas County. I'm a member of the commission. The commission centralizes and organizes the accountability and budgeting for addiction prevention and treatment services in Oregon. I speak in favor of it. I'm passing out copies of my written testimony, and there's also a summary of a blueprint for the states on the back side of the cover sheet. There are six recommendations. These recommendations came from a national policy panel in 2006. The policy panel was chaired by former Governor Michael Dukakis. And they make six recommendations to states to improve the structure and delivery of their addiction prevention and treatment services. Those recommendations are leadership, structure, resources, accountability, legislation, and an advisory process. House Bill 3110 responds to each of those recommendations. It asks the leadership of the executive, judicial, and legislative branches to come together to address alcohol and drug problems. It creates a structure where they meet on a regular basis for coordinated budgeting and purchase and delivery of services. It recognizes that resources are limited and that resources need to be used more efficiently and effectively. It creates an accountability system. Attorney General Kroger spoke of the need to develop this system. I think Oregon can take a leadership position in developing that system. The legislation is an attempt to identify and restructure services. Most states passed enabling legislation for addiction prevention and treatment in the 1970s. It's time that we revisited that legislation and made it germane to today. And finally, the advisory committee that's part of the commission includes a broad representation of constituents and constituency groups. House Bill 3110 will enable Oregon to move forward and deliver treatment for the 21st century rather than treatment for the 20th century. We recognize today that we need a recovery-oriented system of care, a system of care that is not admission-discharge. The system has had a history of repeat admissions. We can no longer blame the patient for repeat admissions. We have to look at the organization and delivery of care, change that organization and delivery of care to work effectively with patients on an ongoing basis so that we are reducing the harms of alcohol drug problems to the Commonwealth, to the state. And finally, I am aware of how difficult it is to organize and deliver a statewide strategic plan. Between 1989 and 1995, I was the Director of Substance Abuse Services for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Oregon has a unique opportunity to be proactive, to implement the recommendations of the Blueprint for States, and in doing so, will ensure itself a better, more effective addiction prevention treatment service. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Bobby?
Hello. I'm John King.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry, John.
Representative Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. I'm a member of the commission. I am an addict in recovery. And I have been uniquely privileged to be a part of this process. To quote a line in one of my favorite movies, Boys in the Hood, they say, either the people who are allowing this to occur don't know, don't show, or don't care. As a member of this committee, I have seen members show up. Recently, we had Attorney General Kroger at the Miracles Club and other members of the commission who showed. And they are people who I have served with on the committee, who I have traveled back and forth to Salem to do the business of the commission, who have shown how much they care and their commitment to this process as a lifelong dedication that they have had in the field. I feel also uniquely privileged to be among the talent pool of people on this commission. It's phenomenal. It is very humbling to be in the presence of such bright minds. It has encouraged me, in fact, to pursue my own education. And it has encouraged me to become a better member of the state of Oregon as a citizen. And it has encouraged the community that I serve, in the recovery community in North Northeast Portland, to have faith that they are represented, that their voice is being heard, that I carry a message on their behalf. It has made people less apathetic and more willing to be a part of the process. I believe that community recovery is what we are about. I believe that community recovery reflects, like a mirror, whatever efforts are put into it. As they say, you get in what you get out what you put in. If we look at the report by Eco Northwest that showed that there was a $5.9 billion loss of revenue to the state of Oregon due to the alcohol and drug usage in this state, the most important resource that is reflected there is the human resource. The human resource is what I represent as a part of the commission, that we are wasting bright minds, youth, and, just a wealth of productivity that does not take place as a result of people not having access to effective treatment and recovery services, and also, beyond that, a complete rethinking of us as members of the same community. We are all connected, irregardless. It's not a us and them thing. It's not they're an addict and I'm not. It's we're all affected on the bottom line. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Any questions from this panel? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to say how pleased I am to see Dr. McCarty here, who I worked with first in the National Academy of Science Committee, to talk about linking research in this area to treatment, and he's one of the top three or four experts in the country in this area. I wonder if you might comment on two things, Dennis. One, on Representative Widener's request about your experience with very effective treatment programs. And second, what's the one thing you think we could do to improve this whole area in the state of Oregon? I'll ask you the easy questions.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Greenlick. The good news is that addictions treatment is effective. If you compare addictions treatment to other chronic illnesses, diabetes, asthma, heart disease, at 12 months, 50% of the people are in stable recovery. On an average, sometimes it's 60%, sometimes it's higher. It's a chronic disease. If an individual stabilizes on blood pressure medication and stops taking their medication, we say, well, get back on the medication. The treatment is effective. When an individual with alcohol drug problems relapses, we say, well, treatment's ineffective. We've got to struggle with how we view addictions prevention and treatment. We need to view it as a chronic illness. We need to create a treatment infrastructure that allows treatment programs to engage with patients over prolonged periods of time rather than for just brief acute care periods for those patients who need that kind of treatment. Oregon's system for data collection and monitoring is antiquated. It's time to bury it. It's time to come into the 21st century. I think we can build on what the Oregon Health Authority is doing so that we build an effective accountability system with minimal cost. That's the opportunity. It's only then that we can begin to compare programs and say which program is more effective, which patients are more effective, which treatment providers, which practitioners are more effective. And it will give us a new level of accountability and a new level of ability to manage our limited resources. In terms of one thing that Oregon can do to enhance the quality of its addiction prevention and treatment services, I would encourage them broadly to follow the evidence, to follow the science. I was at a hearing of the commission earlier this last summer, and a county came in to talk about its prevention and treatment services. They spoke very eloquently about the investment they had made in residential treatment. I'm pleased that they made the investment, but the 10 or 20 people who benefit from that residential treatment are far fewer than the thousands of residents they have who need effective outpatient services, and the research shows that, in general, outpatient services are as effective as inpatient services for most men and women. I probed a little bit. I said, well, what about people who need medication for their addictions treatment? And the county responded that if somebody is opioid dependent, they send them to the next county for maintenance treatment. So they're cost shifting to the next county. I probed. I said, you've got physicians in your county who are licensed to prescribe these medications. They said, well, our county psychiatrist doesn't believe in them. Oregon can no longer tolerate a system that allows leaders of addictions treatment not to believe in the science of addictions treatment. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the reasons I was eager to hear this bill is because of my co-chair's commitment to the area. And so it's nice to hear from two more members of the commission with very different perspectives, so I appreciate that very much. I'm going to shift a little bit over to you, Mr. Harris, and say the Attorney General talked about five things the bill did, and the last one, I'm paraphrasing, and I think I found it in the bill, is the ability of the new structure and of the new, would we call him the director of the commission,
mm-hmm.
to make specific budget recommendations. Now, in a sense, you know, you are one of the silos that we're considering here. I don't want us to, in our, we use this cliche a lot around this building, in our attempt to get at this, break down the silos, just to create another silo. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't either. I don't want us in our attempt to get efficiency to become just another layer of government. So, to me, the way the Attorney General laid it out, the money question sort of comes after the other aspects of this bill. But I would submit that we are, and we all know this, this is no news, we are in a tough budget crunch. I have no problem with the kinds of issues we've raised of intervention, prevention, treatment. But something's got to give. Now, if all these silos are saying we're excited about this bill and we want to work together and coordinate our efforts, where's the money going to come from now to add another layer, to add the director? And are departments, in your view, willing to talk about that part of the budget? This is not the Ways and Means process. I agree. I understand that. But we're going to need to find the dough now to do this. And are the programs already stretched thin? Are they willing to help us find the money within their budgets to make this happen?
Mr. Co-Chair, could I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Richard is close by. We can get his response to that later. We have one, two, three, four more people coming to testify on this bill, and we have another bill where I know people have come from out of town. So you ask an excellent question, and I would imagine it's going to be a rather complicated response. Would you be willing to come back at another time, Richard, and we'll have another public hearing on this, and we can get your response? Would that make sense?
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, I'd be glad to come and talk about this at some point. The short answer is I think we have to find a way to fund a lean and mean organization like this in order. It's an investment. I'm looking at it as an investment in our department.
And I, Madam Chair, that's a good suggestion. Thank you. It's a good suggestion. And I want to get back to this. I agree.
Absolutely.
We need to move on. And I agree it's an investment. Just doesn't mean that we have more money. But I agree, and we need to talk about this particular list. But
and
please,
we will.
Proceed.
We will, absolutely. We need another hearing. A really quick question, Representative.
Madam Chair, I will. The question, and I will ask for it. It takes a lot longer as well. The question that Representative Greenlick asked Dr. McCarty, frankly, I'd like to ask you, Johnny, briefly. If there's one thing that Oregon can do right now that would make a difference, what would it be?
I think that the to keep the dialogue open. Very often I see where a bill comes forward and never makes it out of committee, and that even though it is looked upon as vital and important and could have a outstanding effect, that the balance between practicality and doing the right thing, often practicality outweighs doing the right thing. And I would think if Oregon does the right thing, that they will see that supporting this effort will have a much greater practical impact in the future than satisfying an immediate need. You know, my mother told me long ago, tomorrow is another day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Just real quick, John, congratulations. So you make a lot of people proud. Richard, this is for you because I have to be very fast here. Something to think about when you come back on this. I'm just looking at the steps and everything here, and lots of times when we're dealing with drug and alcohol dependency, lots of times it's mental health issues as well. And I see a good structure here, and one of the complaints and one of the things I'm seeing, like in our state hospital, different places, our mental health program is kind of all over the map. And I wonder if we shouldn't be looking at this closer to incorporate everything to take care of the mental health issues and everything to where the program is an all-encompassing rather than just focused on addictions here primarily, but we start looking at the mental health side and streamline everything to where it's into one cohesive unit rather than piecemealing it together like we are right now. You can, if you want to make a quick comment, if Representative Tomei will let you, you're more than welcome to. But when you come back, this is kind of what's on my mind and how we need to be addressing this to actually truly get in and start attacking the problem.
Representative Widener, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, I'd be glad to address this at length in, another time we can do that.
Great. Thank you. Good question. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, gentlemen. With that, we will move on to Sarah. I'm so sorry. Thank you for being willing to sit aside there. Stephanie Soares, Jonathan Eames, and then we next have, after this trio, we have Sally Pena. Thank you, ladies. And Jonathan, didn't I see Jonathan? Oh, there he is. Go ahead, Sarah.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Goforth. I'm the Director of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services at Central City Concern, a nonprofit in Multnomah County. I am also a member of this commission as well as a person in recovery for more than 25 years. I don't often reveal that information because of the incredible stigma that is attached to folks in recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction. However, recently I was at one of the most exciting things I've ever attended as a provider. The Office of National Drug and Alcohol Drug Control Policy, I shouldn't say it's really drug control policy, convened a recovery summit. It was the third one in a row, and I was able to attend it. And they have opened a recovery branch to their organization, which I never thought I would see it. It was truly a historical moment for me, having worked in this field for more than 20 years. And in that room, and people started standing up, I won't reveal their names because they, I'm sure, would like to do that themselves in the arenas that they feel are appropriate. Many people, highly placed political folks, stood up and started talking about the fact that they'd been in long-term recovery. So I feel like we are in the middle of an exciting national movement. We are coalescing as people across federal agencies, state agencies, and county agencies. Honestly, I didn't think I would see that in my professional career, so I'm very excited to be here. I'll be very brief. Most of the things that have been said are things that I was going to say. So as a provider, I have not become involved in state efforts. I've worked in Washington State as well as Oregon. I felt like my time was better used at the county level, and I'm very involved at the county level. However, when I was asked to apply for a place on the commission, I agreed to because I felt that this could be a very exciting thing, and it has been. For the first time, we have pulled a body together to address the things that you've heard, research, outcomes, accountability. What you haven't heard about really is also to make evidence-based practice accessible to all treatment programs, as well as gear up the workforce that we are going to need as national and local health care reform continues to be rolled out. We're going to need some political will behind that. I work, as I've said, at Central City Concern, and I oversee a number of programs, and one of our programs is called the Hooper Center, Detoxification Stabilization Center, as well as Cheers and Sobering. I won't get into what those are. If I were to drop by early this morning at 7:30, there would be 50 people waiting to come into detox, and I will tell you that there is an increasing and somewhat alarming number of young people with their parents, 18 to 21. Only 10 or 12 will get in today, depending on how sick the population is. If it's very sick, then nurses are needed for more individual care, and therefore we can take less people. Part of that is due to finances. This is not the Ways and Means Committee, so I'm not going to talk very much about money. We need to do a better job of reaching people. Currently, 30% of the people that need treatment receive treatment. Nationally and locally, our figures for folks completing treatment is less than 50%. At Central City Concern, I'm very fortunate because I work in a recovery-oriented system of care. We're a federally qualified health care for the homeless agency. Therefore, we have access, the folks that come into our agency have access to employment programs, supported housing, medical care, mental health, as well as addiction treatment services. However, that's one agency in Multnomah County. There are many, many agencies across the state that could benefit from those recovery supports. And recovery systems-oriented care is the federal national initiative that they've been rolling out for 4 years and now really has some teeth in it. And this particular commission has some teeth in it. Dr. Goldberg, Attorney General John Kroger, Richard Harris, Dr. McCarty, just to name a few. I, too, feel very privileged to work with so much talent, as John said, to be counted among the voices as a provider and a person in recovery. We haven't done a good enough job, and I say we, I mean providers and folks in recovery, of telling our story. Many people in long-term recovery, as I referenced before, don't want to get up here. They don't want to talk about that. There are a lot of reasons for that. Faces and Voices of Recovery is a national consumer movement that has organized itself and has done a great job in convening panels and having their stories heard. However, we haven't been in Salem very much over the years. We haven't been organized very well. When I walk the halls, I see plenty of my colleagues that run mental health organizations, and I work, I hate to say two different silos because they really are together, but I have to tell you the finances and contracts are very different. And they are here all the time. We're very lucky to have Jonathan Eames, well, it's true, the last 2 years as a very strong lobby voice for alcohol and drug services. We haven't necessarily had it before. So the commission gives us an opportunity to show up in Salem. I wouldn't be here if I hadn't been asked and if I wasn't part of the commission. I do believe the treatment works and we are doing a good job in Oregon. However, we must do a better job. I feel that the coordinated voices of DHS, juvenile and adult justice, the education folks, the Oregon Health Authority, has an opportunity to give you one message, not a siloed message, one message: the treatment works, and we want to pull that accountability around it, and I believe that this commission can do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Stephanie. Good morning, Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Suarez-Pump. I am the prevention chair of OPRA, the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association. I also served as the chair of the Alcohol and Drug Council, on which was the predecessor to the commission. At the time the commission bill was being developed last session, while I was working on that bill with the governor's office and the AG's office, the thing that concerned me the most about the bill we were developing was its sunset clause. And so here we are, two years later. I'm here to tell you that I believe it is critical that this commission continue. Alcohol and drug, as you know, impacts, people say it's the driver. It affects 18 state agencies and commissions and organizations, and that's just the public sector. I think that the economic impact has been well documented. What is not as well documented is the precious few resources that we have had to support prevention, treatment, and recovery services. We've been woefully underfunded ever since I can remember, and the prevention side was essentially dismantled with the economic crisis of the early 2000s. Some of that's been restored, but not all of it. 3110 goes a long way toward reinstituting prevention services. I believe it is vital that we continue this process, if for no other reason than in my 36 years of working in prevention, treatment, and recovery in the state of Oregon, this is the first time where I have experienced the poobahs, if you would pardon my colloquialism, who come before you and say we need to work together, and that they, in fact, have formed a mechanism by which to do that. The ability to have the departments unsilo themselves, I think, is a remarkable thing. The fact that we made an attempt to do this several sessions ago through the Commission on Children and Families, and that it worked in some places and not others, tells me that the potential for this to work is there. The fact that the heads of these agencies, and including elected officials, are willing to do this, I think reinforces the potential for this to work. The other thing that I think is critical is the fact that this is that the director's position would be supported by the governor's office. Frankly, if you have a situation like we do with substance abuse that does impact 18 state agencies, placing this in the governor's office seems logical and appropriate to me, given that it needs that level of attention. Given that we haven't given it that level of attention in the past, we have the situation we have today with the billions of dollars that are impacted,
Stephanie,
and the lives.
I've just been given a list of this many people who are waiting
okay.
to testify.
Thank you for
and
your
you,
time.
Well, you have been a fantastic supporter of this issue. And what I would, in fact, if both of you would like to send us something in writing through the staff, that would be wonderful, because I think what you have to say is really important. And not everybody was here to hear what you had to say. So if you could put that in writing, that would be great.
I will.
Jonathan, you're here every day. Say something quickly, and then we will have you back. We'll be having another public hearing later.
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eanes, from the Oregon, representing here from the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, OPRA. I am here only because our chair, our president of the board, is sick, Tim Hartnett, and so I was just here to let you know that OPRA strongly supports the passage of House Bill 3110, and a number of the board members, Stephanie's a board member, and Sarah is also a member of OPERA. I have already spoken to you, so I will not go on. This is a critically important bill. Cross-cut state agencies, a unified budget is very important when you're dealing with alcohol and drug issues that looks at different state agencies, because it is not just an issue for AMH or Oregon Health Authority. So we really urge your passage. And if you do have concerns or questions, obviously the Attorney General's office, but also OPERA is here to help and answer questions if you need. Thank you very much.
And if Tim, you'd like to invite Tim to send us written testimony, that would be terrific.
Absolutely.
Thank you so
he will.
Much.
He very much apologizes.
Thank you so much, ladies. Also, Sally Panna, am I pronouncing that correctly? And colleagues, floor session is at 10:30, I think, today.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if you wouldn't mind, people have come from out of town, some young people who are missing school. I want to make sure that we can hear everybody who has come to testify today. So if you can stay a little bit afterwards, that would be terrific.
10, 10.
Pardon?
I'll see you till about 10, 10.
Yeah. Okay, terrific. Thank you. Yes.
My name is Sally Panna, and I'm going to condense my testimony in the interest of time. But I'm here to support the bill. And I'm also asking, though, that the bill be slightly amended to include an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist. Alcohol and drug evaluation specialists, of which I am one, have worked for 30 years with DUI offenders in Oregon. Courts refer defendants to us for diagnostic assessment, and then we refer the defendants to education or treatment programs and monitor their compliance. We work very closely with defendants, over 25,000 of them, every year throughout the state. And I would just ask that we put an amendment in here to include us at the table. The main reason that I support this bill is because it is an open process. Recently, we have been dealing with DUII rule changes proposed by AMH, in which the process was very, very closed. When I go to addictions and alcohol policy commission meetings, there is always an opportunity for the public to express their views. I think that is critically important, particularly when you're dealing with budgets of this size. I don't agree with all of the suggestions that have been made in terms of policy. For example, I think it's very important that we explore more the options of AA and education, which are much cheaper. I think that we have to restrict our budgets. Instead of saying we need more money, I think we need to look at reducing the amount of funding in light of where we're at in terms of our economy. I think we need to enhance private agencies so that they're working and are encouraged to work and pick up some of the pieces of this puzzle. I think that we need to encourage more prevention. One of the things that I would like them to look at is, for example, is why cigarette smoking has decreased so much. We haven't spent billions of dollars on cigarette treatment programs, but nevertheless, cigarette smoking is down in huge amounts. Things like this that can come at no or reduced cost should take priority. I support the bill. I think it's a good one. I am very excited about the people that are on the commission, the depth of experience, and the fact that many of them are elected officials who we can hold accountable. I think it's wonderful. I would just have the one amendment that would add us as ADISes to that commission.
Thank you so much, Sally. And if you could also present us with written material,
I apologize.
You have to say is very important.
I'm a novice. I've got it here.
Thank you. Good. Thank you so much. With that, we are going to close the House Committee on House Bill 3110, and we will be having another hearing on this in the future. And we will now open the House Committee on House Bill 2235. Jennifer, and could Celia Andor, Jenny Schwan, and Joanne Rogovoy come up. Wendy, shouldn't you be first? Where's Wendy?
I went already last time.
Okay, all right.
Unless you need me.
Okay, all right. All right, thank you.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2235 was originally heard on the 14th of February. It requires Oregon Health Authority to provide training and informational materials concerning maternal mental health to health care providers serving pregnant, postpartum, and post-pregnancy loss patients. Requires hospitals and healthcare providers serving referenced patients to provide materials published or approved by the Oregon Health Authority, and allows the Oregon Health Authority to apply for federal grants to provide training and materials. You do have provided some amendments as well relative to the bill.
I called up three people who haven't showed up. Celia Andor, Danny Schwan, and Joanne Mogavoy. All right. So somebody start.
Co-Chair Tomei and Gilliam and committee members, my name is Sheila Andor. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Corvallis, and I have submitted a written testimony, and I'm going to shorten my verbal one for sake of time. I am one of the Oregon State Coordinators of Postpartum Support International. I am the co-founder and former executive director of Well Mama, Inc., a Eugene-based nonprofit agency that provides counseling, social support, resources, and advocacy to pregnant, postpartum, and post-pregnancy loss women who suffer from mental illness. I am the founder and head of Well Mama, Lynn Benton, the local chapter of Postpartum Support International. I am in psychotherapy private practice with a perinatal mental health focus. I am a survivor of pregnancy and postpartum depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'm missing one. A lot of that. I was not diagnosed. I went without treatment for a long time. I became suicidal at some point. I had a really bad course. I detailed this in my written testimony. Once I found Postpartum Support International online and self-diagnosed when my baby was about 8 months old, I finally figured out what was going on with me, and at that time I started providing support myself to other women on the phone at that time, and then started my private practice in psychotherapy with this focus. Since then I have worked in this specialty, both as a psychotherapist and a volunteer providing treatment, social support resources, and advocacy. I have made numerous unsolicited contacts to medical and social service providers to offer them related information, educational materials from Postpartum Support International, and what I had created myself at home. I have given numerous talks to providers, and I have been one of the handful of professionals in Oregon who have provided training to healthcare and social service providers who serve perinatal women. Interested providers continually contact me to inquire about training opportunities, about perinatal mental health issues, just for me to tell them that I am not aware of any upcoming ones in the near future. In terms of printed patient education materials, some providers in Corvallis, Albany, and Lebanon in the area where I live, including the hospital maternity wards, use the ones I have provided to them from Postpartum Support International, which is a volunteer-based organization that primarily provides mom-to-mom support. So this is not a organization of professionals or government entities. The hospital nearby where I live also use handouts and pamphlets that I created on my own laptop. They do not provide pamphlets or material provided by any government agencies.
Would you provide for us some of those materials?
Yes.
That would be great in the future.
Yes,
Thank you.
Can email that.
And I'm going to ask, I know you've written material there, so I'm going to ask you to speed up because we have so many people here.
I am here to support the bill, and thank you very much.
And thank you all that you've done. That's great.
Okay. Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and committee members, I'm Joanne Rogovoy, State Director of Program Services and Public Affairs for March of Dimes. I would like to urge you to support House Bill 2235. March of Dimes is an established organization dedicated to improving the health of newborns by preventing birth anomalies, premature birth, and infant mortality. Maternal depression can affect women during pregnancy, and that's an issue that we are concerned about, the pregnant woman and her baby and the serious risks that it carries. Depression during pregnancy contributes to premature birth, fetal growth restriction, poor nutrition, poor weight gain, use of drugs and alcohol during pregnancy to self-medicate, and suicide. We think that House Bill 2235 would be important to standardize information that's given to pregnant women and around depression. I will just cut this testimony short. I have it written, but the costs of preterm birth and birth anomalies are substantial, And if you're looking at health care costs, you're increasing health care costs by at least 11 times when you have a poor pregnancy outcome. I think that prevention is key here, and we have an opportunity to help.
Statistic in her material, colleagues. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, that gives us something very concrete to be aware of. Thank you so much. And Danny.
Juan? Schwartz.
Schwartz,
you must have left a couple letters out.
Yes, you did. I did.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee, I'll also edit my little talk here because I know you have written testimony from me. My name is Daniel Schwartz, and I live in Corvallis with my 7-year-old son, Adam, and my wife, Sheila, who you just heard from. 7 years ago, Sheila had severe depression, anxiety, and panic attacks that started during her pregnancy and continued postpartum. In addition, after the birth, she had postpartum obsessive-compulsive disorder with mental images of harm coming to Adam and post-traumatic distress disorder from birth trauma. During her pregnancy, postpartum period, and the baby's neonatal intensive care unit stay for a life-threatening condition, we had over 100 medical staff caring for her and the baby. Not one ever gave us verbal information or any printed material on perinatal mental illness. Warning signs, symptoms, or risk factors such as medical complications during childbirth or with the baby after birth. We received no information on this. Today, I'd like to share with you just very briefly how our provider's lack of training in this area affected me as a father. I would like to let you know how information about perinatal mental illness would have helped me had we received any. Back then, I thought my wife's emotional difficulties was just her. I assumed that she was simply not as capable as other mothers were. I thought she should have tried harder and that she had been more articulate about what she needed and what kind of help she needed, or what we as a couple needed to do to help better the situation. I felt blamed by her for not doing enough, and yes, she often blamed me because I was the only person around her, other than the baby and my 15-year-old son, who would not have had any reasons for the misery that she was feeling. In her mind, she did not have any knowledge about perinatal mental illness, and my inadequate help with the baby and the household was the reason for her inability to sleep. Her irritability, anger, constant memories of the traumatic birth and its aftermath, they were not going away. Panicky feelings, no energy, no motivation, no joy. Absolutely lack of interest in anything but just getting through the day. Now I know from the countless pamphlets and website pages that she created and I helped edit and proofread that the symptoms were perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. They are not her fault and they are not mine. And she used to call me at work for a variety of reasons, and I won't go into detail about what those conversations were about. If we simply could have received a brochure with a list of symptoms after the panic attack she had in her obstetrician's office at 7 months pregnant, a lot of this could have been avoided. Instead, I got a call from the ER at work that my wife was admitted there for observation after her OB appointment for uncontrollable crying and hyperventilation. After proper pulmonary and cardiac workup, the obstetrician informed her that she was fine and she just had a panic attack. No worries, they said. And along with the no worries statement, no information, no education, and no pamphlets. Well, today my wife has become an expert in this specialty. I know that chronic anxiety during pregnancy is associated with an increased risk of premature delivery. It causes nutrition and oxygen to the fetus, negative consequences on fetal central nervous system development. And by the way, these research studies were shown in the mid-90s, and all of this happened in 2003. So I just wanted to relay the information from a father's perspective, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. That was very moving. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming to testify today and share your experiences with us. And if you have written information, as I said, not everybody is here, and I think everybody needs to learn about your family.
Okay. Thank you
so much. And could you stand up and wave to us? Because it sounds like you're the one that we're talking about. Thank you for coming. Brian Baver, boy, Brian, I'm following that up. Wendy, did you want to come up? And Amy Wise Mendez? Amy, why don't you stay until the end? I mean, Wendy, you stay until the end.
Skip me.
Okay. Amy and Catherine Bradley. Is Catherine still here? Oh, good.
Good morning, Co-Chair Tomei, Gilliam, committee members. My name is Amy Wise Mendez, and I'm here to share my testimony today. I live in Corvallis with my husband and four children. I am a 5-time survivor of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, one with a suicide attempt. The first two episodes of mood disorders were during my pregnancies and postpartum periods in 2002 and 2004. I did not receive any verbal printed education on perinatal mood disorders from any providers in spite of the fact my baby was transported to Eugene Neonatal Intensive Care Unit from Corvallis, which these types of complications put me at higher risk of those mood disorders. In 2006, we lost twins at 14 weeks of pregnancy, and again, no resources or referrals or information on the grieving process was provided. During 2007, pregnancy with my now 3-year-old son, I had multiple medical problems, which now I know statistically put me at a higher risk for mental health problems. Though I was receiving counseling at a county mental health clinic, no aspects of the counseling was specific to pregnancy postpartum issues. The establishment and the counselor had simply no information or training. About a week after delivery, I went home, and 10 weeks later, I was admitted into inpatient psychiatric unit for severe depression. I received absolutely no specific education, resources, and on postpartum illness. In fact, I was discharged home without any information, and I was instructed to continue ongoing counseling at the county mental health clinic, which obviously was not working for me at that time. I was eventually discharged from the inpatient psychiatric admission, and about 10 days later, my husband took me to my primary care for an emergency visit because I was having death wishes. My doctor sent us over to the ER where I asked to be readmitted to the psychiatric unit for proper treatment, as I was not able to care for myself, my family, or my baby. I was denied admission because I had no suicidal thoughts, only death wishes, and was sent home from the ER without resources, education on postpartum mental illness. I was instructed again to continue my counseling at the county mental health clinic. 10 days later, I attempted suicide. Though I love my children and my family, in my severely depressed state, I was convinced that they would be better off without me. I was admitted to a psychiatric unit. This time I was told by staff that my attending psychiatrist happened to be postpartum herself, and therefore she understood that I need perinatal targeted mental health resources, information, and treatment. I am still puzzled by the fact that my psychiatrist had to have been postpartum herself to understand this disease process. It is even more puzzling that the staff presented this is the fact and that this was a true legitimate reason for me to be in the hospital and that I should have been given the proper follow-up care. It seems clear to me that there is a connection between perinatal mood, the perinatal period, and specific mental health concerns is a notion none of my approximately 100 medical staff that worked on my case throughout these pregnancies and postpartum periods. Though I did not receive any of the targeted intervention at this psychiatric visit per my psychiatrist's order, the discharge planner took the time to get online and found Sheila and/or LCSW in Corvallis, who has testified here today. The discharge planner contacted her, and she visited me in the hospital. The next day, she became my counselor, support person, and advocate. She right away provided me with the resources and treatment. No need to say that she herself was, too, at one point in time, an undiagnosed person with postpartum mood disorders. The problem I see with our local medical system is that providers do not have the training, the resources in the area of perinatal mental health. The efforts of volunteers and a few psychotherapists have helped some families, but we need statewide legislative direction that reach all providers in all facilities. That way mothers in the with postpartum depression will not have to get to the point of a suicide attempt, like myself, and be lucky enough to find a psychiatrist who happens to be postpartum herself and recognize the nature of the illness. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. And again, as I've asked the other folks, if you would write that out, it seems like you did write it, and get it to our staff here. Everybody will have that, even those who weren't here. So yes. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
There. They're already set.
All right, great. Thank you. Okay.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, and I'm here today to provide the public health perspective on House Bill 2235. As you've heard from the eloquent testimony, the work that we've been pursuing in this area really has identified some pretty significant gaps. It has been a change in knowledge, a change in practice, and what the committee is proposing on the basis of the work that was done in the work plan that was presented to you last fall is to begin to work on a multi-year approach, this first one really being work on education with providers and with the community. As the testimony here today has really presented, we really can understand that this gap needs to be addressed in some way, and that's really what we are proposing within this bill. Just a couple of other specifics relating to the data. This is almost certainly very specific to our most vulnerable populations. While we know that almost a fourth of new mothers in Oregon report some form of pre- or postnatal depression, 36% of women who are low income, over 42% of women who experience partner-related stress, and also 36% of teens also have reported these. So this inordinately affects those who are some of our most at-risk clients. It's also disproportionate in terms of health disparities. In terms of looking at 33% of American Indians in Oregon report pre- or postnatal depression, 31% of Hispanic, 35% of African American, 25% of Asian Pacific Islanders. So we know from our surveillance data that this really does impact on many of the communities we are working with. The Office of Family Health is available for this conversation and for additional information. We do need to note, however, that this is not in the governor's proposed budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine. Very quickly, Representative.
Very quickly. As you say, this is important. You have a policy option package to do this yourself?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlink, we do not have a policy option package on this, so this is not in the governor's proposed budget.
And I think there is a movement afoot to try to find some way of avoiding the ways and means system, so we'll get back to that in the future. Okay, Brian.
Great. Thank you, Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. I'm Brian Baring with the Oregon Medical Association. And the OMA has been a big supporter of the intent of House Bill 2235 during the last interim session and this session. We think that the maternal mental health patient and provider education program is an important step here. I won't go into the data because I think it's been well covered here. What I do want to put on the record, though, is that in this current environment for physicians, you know, with the 19% cuts to OHP, as well as the changing environment of health reform, we've got some tough hurdles out there. And while we're not excited about a mandate, we think that this is an issue that we need to do the right thing and get these materials into the hands of mothers. One of the things we did want to look at adding is the Dash 2 amendments, and I hope they're in front of you, and this is an issue to address some liability that, like I said, while we do want to do the right thing, we do not want to create an additional liability issue for our physicians trying to get this information into the hands of our mothers. And with that, I'll cut it off.
Thank you so much, Brian. Representative, yes, Mr. Chair.
Catherine, you can send this to us later, but I'm interested in knowing, in addition to what this bill focuses on, is there also a conduit, a vehicle, where we could include information like this?
Yeah.
That we're already providing some other vehicle that it could be included in. Surely we're doing something already to communicate with folks on other issues, other than this being a separate.
Co-chairs and Representative Gilliam specifically, the proposal for this bill is less about the conduit and more about the development of materials and the mechanisms to align with other systems, although it does include a component from our perspective that would be engaging other professional providers to do some of the training and education, because we do know from the research that providers learn best from other colleagues.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we're going to move on to Steve Pierce. Carol, is it Linus? And Maria. Sorry, Maria.
Odessi.
Thank you, Odessi. Some people are leaving, and I'd point out to you that our meeting usually goes until 10 o'clock, but this is on video, and so I'm hoping that the members who are having to leave will be able to watch your testimony on television later. So please, and I apologize for giving you so little time, but thank you so much for coming. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. My name is Stevie Pierce. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights of Oregon, and thank you, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, and representatives. We're concerned about several aspects of this bill. As you can see, this bill seems to represent a shift from a disorganized approach to an organized approach, but it also seems to be shifting to looking at things from the psychiatric lens. And if we're looking at things from the psychiatric marketing aspect, you can compare it to past histories of, you know, you came out with a diagnosis of, ADHD, and you get an explosion of diagnosis of, ADHD, and you get a huge drugging of Ritalin and the resulting side effects, and you can look at various diagnoses that are coming out that will lead to an explosion of diagnosis and treatment. So I don't see how you can get away from this bill and not having a huge impact on the actual treatment, because if you're streamlining the criteria and saying this is what you're going to do, it is going to result in more treatment, and that's going to start impacting as soon as you release these materials. Now, the biggest flaw we see in this bill, as you can see from our testimony, we have like 7 points, and I won't go into all of them, but it's putting the babies and their mothers at risk, we feel, is one of the major concerns on this. A mother taking any drug while pregnant, whether she knows she is or not, or nursing, places her baby at risk of side effects of that drug, attaches a list of the international drug studies and warnings that reveal antidepressants, one of the most common drugs that mothers are going to be using under this type of system, are birth defects, control symptoms, stunted growth, and premature birth. One doctor to point out, it is becoming more and more evident that doctors, many unwittingly, others knowingly, are prescribing drugs that cause more newborns greater harm than infants who have suffered withdrawal symptoms due to their mother's cocaine habit.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you to sum up, and you did give us a lot of information, which I appreciate, and
so,
it will be in everybody's
file. So the main recommendations we would go into are the bill must address the issue of medical conditions, any nutritional deficiencies and environmental factors. The report completely lacked any factors addressing those. You addressed other practitioners. There's no mention of medical concerns, nutritional, other factors that are medical that need to actually be screened for as well, that are already provided for under existing practitioners that need to be included in any common sense approach to dealing with, real factors that mothers are facing, and you have to address those factors. Support systems, there are a lot of systems that are natural and should be provided. But if we're switching over to the psychiatric aspect of things, we're going to be running into certain problems, and there must be full informed consent for the mothers to understand what the ramifications of these drugs are, because these drugs come with their own package of problems and side effects. And you need to be warned that these are going to happen, and you're going to get mothers. You can look at critically examine some of the situations where these mothers have run into crises, and they've been poorly treated by the mental health system. So,
thank you, Stephen.
Yes,
thank you for your materials. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Carol Lurix, and I am a postpartum anxiety and depression survivor. I'm also a volunteer with Baby Blues Connection, a Portland area support group, and I am a mental health practitioner. I recently finished school. I will be brief. The main things I want to talk about are the importance of screening. Over time, a lot of women, like myself, become increasingly more depressed and anxious as the postpartum time goes by. And often women are not asked past, you know, maybe their last OB or midwife appointment at 6 or 8 weeks. A lot of women don't have symptoms or minimize symptoms or still, you know, in the fugue of a new motherhood at that time. We need to train people to keep asking, to ask non-judgmentally, and to provide resources and support. That's why I think the training is so important. I would tend to disagree that training is necessarily going to cause more psychiatric diagnoses. As you heard before, a lot of people like myself were undiagnosed and therefore untreated in any way. There are many types of treatments. There are many drugs and treatments that are deemed safe. And the risk of not treating mothers while pregnant and postpartum can really devastate lives and child development, as we heard from the March of Dimes and from the survivors. So I know that I had a hard time, and I know that training of my providers, having them come back non-judgmentally, sensitively, asking me, how are you doing? Somebody asks you, how are you doing? What are you going to say? Fine. But to really probe, to really be trained, to look for symptoms, to dig, not just give a questionnaire, I think that would have helped me, and that will help many more people. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. And if you could put your thoughts in writing, that would be very helpful. Thank you so much. I know. Okay, thank you for coming today, all of you coming to speak to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tomei, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Maria Desi. I'm a member of Postpartum Support International as a volunteer. I was hired in 2001 by the Behavioral Care Network here in Salem that manages the prevention money for the mental health money for 5 counties, including Polk and Marion. Since then, I'm a provider through courses like this one provided by Dr. Ricardo Munoz and his colleagues that I use for groups. I run support groups. At this point, I have the collaboration of Salem Hospital, who provides me with the free room, space, and all the support to run a group there for women who speak English. I run a group at a teen parent school here in Chemeketa. I run a group with a mother's group, the women who are in recovery, and I run groups in Spanish through Marion County, Woodburn, and 2 groups in Salem in collaboration with churches who provide free space and their support. It is true that there is alarming concern, but in my experience,
get back a little bit from
the education
better, thank you.
To the mothers by their physicians, it is highly important. We had meetings where the physicians confessed that their lack of knowledge took him to not even want to look at the issue, move it at one side. They have 15 minutes when the women come in, and they're not able because we don't have the vocabulary, like many have expressed. We do not know the names of our symptoms. We sort of say, I do not feel well. Most of the women, through the courses, through the information, are able to receive enough knowledge so that they communicate with their doctor. They don't necessarily have to resort to medication. Actually, most of them don't want the medication. They prefer to try the support groups. Through this program, I'm able to support the women who are Oregon Health Plan members. Becoming a volunteer to Postpartum Support International opens my door to provide support to the other women. I do like to urge you to support this bill because this is the bottom. This is the cement for the family to prevent many of the issues that we have heard previously as alcohol and drug addiction. As a mother, I suffer postpartum depression with a small child, and with 6 months of pregnancy, my husband divorced me because he was not prepared to deal with what I was going through. Likely, not through the professionals, but women in the community who supported me, I was able to really say I was raised by three beautiful daughters. One of them who became a student at the Naval Academy, who has served our country as an officer, has gone to two trips to our problems in the world, and now, as a turn, because depression runs in families, as a turn, I've been able to be there for my three daughters as they were touched by the same ailment, because it runs in families. Because of these, many women have been able to pursue their careers once they overcome the depression, but understanding what it is that needs to be managed. And they've been able to also strive to maintain, by the cooperation of their husband, lasting and positive relationships that are so needed to raise our families today.
Maria, thank you so much for your testimony. And if you could put some of that in writing, it's very compelling. It would be great for the people who haven't been able to be here to listen to your testimony. If we could put it in our files, that would
thank
be great.
Thank you. And I would like to add that the Behavioral Care Network does have a statistic information on the outcomes of the program since 2000 when they began. So I will gather some and forward it to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for coming today.
Thank you.
How many people are here about this issue who haven't had a chance to speak? Okay, great. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to have to close the hearing on House Bill 2235. We will be having another, and we will be having a work session. And with that, I will be closing the House Committee on Human Services. So.